My name is Nora Lawrence, and I'm a curatorial assistant here in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. And I worked on the Color Chart exhibition with the curator Anne Temkin. It's on display on the sixth floor of the museum until May 12th. And I encourage you, if you haven't had a chance to go and see it yet, you should. This is the first show in MoMA's history ever to be devoted to the topic of color. It includes work by 44 artists in which color is really a central point of concern. With the exception of one work created by Marcel Duchamp that we'll talk about, an artist whose use of color could be seen as ahead of his time, the art included in the Color Chart exhibition dates from the year 1950 to the present day. I'm going to talk about 12 of the different artists in the show. All of the artists in Color Chart have accepted color as a mass-produced and store-bought commodity. For them, color holds no spiritual, emotional, or scientific truth. It's just a fact of life. So this is not the spiritual color of Kandinsky, it's not the emotional color of Matisse, and it's not the scientific color of Seurat. It's sort of a new generation of colorists. Artists in the show have made decisions regarding color by following either chance operations, non-aesthetic systems, so either, say, alphabetizing or a mathematical system, or by finding colors from a ready-made source. They're not mixing their color on a traditional artist palette. They're not trying to express a certain mood. They're just engaging with colors that are already available to them in the world. As I hope you'll agree, what they've been able to come up with is really varied results and really beautiful results, even though they're working with these restricted set of options. As we were putting together the show, we weren't trying to be comprehensive. If you are thinking of other artists who maybe you would have included in this show, we love that, because the idea is more that this is a huge phenomenon, and we've picked some. I bet you could think of some others who could also fit in just as well. The interest in mass-produced color at the latter half of the 20th century could be seen as an effect of standardization in all walks of society after World War II. You could think of the rise of mass-produced housing and people being offered maybe, say, 8 or 9 different options for their tract house, or even 8 or 9 different colors to put on those houses. Also, the rise of television, standardized society, the rise of media, and also now more recently the internet. So people have common reference points, and color is yet another one. The rise of multinational corporations and chains selling the same products worldwide. Someone can buy the same shirt at the Gap, say, in New York or in Singapore or in England. People can go to McDonald's all over the world, buy the same computer from Microsoft. Everything's just become this way. And what we're saying is that the same thing is true with color. And color charts in hardware stores introduce this idea of color as a ready-made commodity to consumers. The economic necessity of moving towards, say, house paint or different types of industrial paints also played a role for artists in the exhibition. If you're Jackson Pollock, it's going to be a lot more expensive if you're only using small tubes of artist paint than if you're able to sort of use a can of house paint. And so that really played a part. Also, a lot of the greatest innovations in paint making were happening on the industrial level rather than on the level of artist paint. So electric guitars were coming out with sort of amazing new and vibrant colors with metal flake in them that artists took to. Car lacquers were coming out in these really shiny, bright, and solid colors that artist colors just weren't providing at the same time. These are some early color charts. The one on the top is from around 1900 from the company Duco, and the one at the bottom, the one on the top is 1920 from Duco. The one on the bottom from Calcimo Wall Colors is from around 1900. Color charts became something that you'd see every day in hardware stores beginning around 1880. And up until World War II, they were hand-painted, so you could actually see the direct color that you would be buying. This has proved enormously helpful to our conservation department because they've been able to test the different colors that they've purchased from these color charts off of eBay. They've been getting a lot of them. And just know exactly what artists who were using these industrial colors were using in their work. And right around World War II, color charts became mass-produced, printed, standardized, and so they weren't with the actual paint on them as much. the color chart is the central metaphor for this show because of the arrangements of colors in a color chart. As you can see, there's a possibility to have more of a spectrum, colors that are ordered like they are a little bit more on the Duco chart. But then on the Calcimo chart, you can see that these colors are just completely random. They're just all individual products. They have nothing to do with each other in terms of any sort of spectrum. So this is really the type of color that we're thinking of, no more than a product. The first work that I want to talk about is Marcel Duchamp's Tomb, from 1918. Duchamp was paid $1,000 to make this painting by his longtime patron, Catherine Dreyer. She commissioned it for a space above her bookshelf in her Central Park West apartment, and that's why it's long and narrow, and that's also why if you look at it upstairs, it's the bottom of it is 8 feet in the air because we've replicated its spacing above the bookshelf. Duchamp had finished painting, as far as he was concerned, about 4 years earlier. So this was a return to painting for him. And perhaps he was reluctant to return. The title Tomb, T-U space M apostrophe, in French means you do something to me. So it's been often filled in with words like you annoy me, you enrage me. You can think of these anything that begins with a vowel, really, in French, and fill it in, and it was sort of maybe what he was saying to painting at the time. In this slide, we can see that Duchamp was really showing his past history since about 1913 in the painting Tomb. We have up here a shadow of a bicycle wheel, which was a famous ready-made that he made in 1913. And then here we have a hat rack, which here is shown again, was another ready-made that Duchamp made. So one thing that he's doing with this stream of colors across the surface here is pronouncing color to be just another ready-made, like his other ready-mades that he'd already made. We know that Duchamp got these from a paint manufacturer's catalog, and you can see again that they're not arranged in a perfect spectrum. The colors are somewhat more random than they would be in sort of a color wheel. And we also have reason to believe that his girlfriend at the time, Yvonne Chastel, was the person painting them for him. So he really was giving up painting in certain ways and not dealing with Tomb as much as he could have. This illusionistic hand here was also painted by a professional sign painter. So he's sort of equating professional painting, artistic painting as one. We also have a real ready-made here. This is a real bottle brush. If you go upstairs, you can see it sticks out from the painting about 2 feet. This work by Robert Rauschenberg on the top is called Rebus. It's from 1955, and Rauschenberg had an opportunity to see Duchamp's Tomb 2 years before in a Dada exhibition in 1953 at the Sydney Janus Gallery. And what we have in Rebus is is Rauschenberg taking Duchamp's idea of ready-made color one step further. Rather than painting in these color chips as Duchamp has in Tomb, Rauschenberg just got color chips from a catalog and just pasted them directly onto his painting. If you go upstairs, you can see that they still have all the perforations at the top that they would have if you just pulled them out of the book. There are 117 of these color swatches across the center. And Rauschenberg is also included in color chart not only for those swatches, but because of the way he approached paint in the 1950s for these combine paintings, which were these collage paintings that he did at this time. He would buy remaindered paint down on the Bowery, and what he liked about remaindered paint was not only that it was cheaper, it was half price, but also that he would never know what color it was because it wasn't labeled. So he would go in and just buy whatever they had, and he made a rule for himself that he would have to use every color that he bought, at least some of it, even if he didn't like it. So for him, using this paint was just like something completely random. We didn't quite know what was going to happen. He had a term for color that I think is really helpful for our show. He had a term for color that he liked, which he called pedestrian color, which he thought was the type of no color of a group of people that you see walking down the street. You can't quite tell individually which color is which. And he is thinking of color as something salvaged from the street or salvaged from everyday life in this type of painting. The canvas that he was making was also just on a drop cloth from his studio. It wasn't a fine art canvas. He was using different collage elements from political posters and other parts of life. So he was really combining paint as just yet another thing and color just as yet another product in life. This is Eve Klein's Eve Pencher from 1954. And it's a booklet, if you can see, basically, all of these sheets, I tried to make them the same size as much as possible, but they all fit together in a book. And what it is supposed to be is a book of monochrome paintings, reproductions of monochrome paintings that Klein claimed to have made between 1951 and 1954. There's no evidence that he actually did make all of these paintings, so as many things are with Eve Klein, it might be an enormous joke, it might be something more realistic, but we know that he had been experimenting with monochrome paintings in the years before 1954, but not that he had specifically made any of these. But what he does is he puts his Eve right down here, and with some of them that I didn't include, he'll sign them right on the printed paper that he uses. And then they'll also have the year and place where they were made, as well as dimensions. So it'll say in Tokyo, 1952, and then 111 by 96 or something like that. But we don't know that it ever really occurred. He made this booklet in Madrid with his friend Claude Pascal. And you can see that the preface is written by Pascal Claude. And also, as part of this enormous joke, the preface doesn't actually have anything to say about the works. So it's sort of a question. Is he being serious or is he making a joke on us? What does he think about monochrome painting? And what's interesting to us for this show is not only that he just used these cut-out pieces of paper to stand in for paintings, not photographic reproductions, but also that he was combining what you usually think of as the high art monochrome or something very serious with something that's just such a huge joke. A few years later, he would patent a color in his name, as a lot of you have probably heard, International Klein Blue, he actually got a patent on and started referring to himself as Yves Le Monochrome. So he was really sort of interested in promoting this idea of himself, neither as one way or the other, neither serious nor joking. This is Frank Stella's Benjamin Moore series from 1961 to 1962. And someone had mentioned at the last talk that you can't quite tell, but it's the primary and secondary colors. Here's red, and that's orange. They're supposed to look more different than they do on the screen. Sorry about that. Stella had moved to New York in 1958, and when he did, he supported himself as a house painter. He had already, by the time he did these paintings, he had already done a series of paintings in black paint, and then in copper paint, and in aluminum paint. He really didn't like what he thought of as the expressive drama of abstract expressionist painting of someone like Jackson Pollock or Willem de Kooning. And he said that he liked, quote, the nice dead kind of color that you could get from house paints. He had a famous quote that said, quote, I tried to keep the paint as good as it was in the can. And that's essentially what these are. All of the colors in these works are readily available just as Benjamin Moore house paints, and he gives you that right away in the title of the series. The one work that is not is this purple. There was no purple house paint available at the time, so he combined red and blue, and what you get is this purple that has since faded to gray. He named all of these individual paintings, the individual titles, not the series title, after American battles or different moments in American wars. From left to right on the top row, there are Delaware Crossing, Hampton Roads, Island Number 10, and then on the bottom, it's New Madrid, Palmito Ranch, and Sabine Pass. And so the sort of emotive or descriptive titles are sort of belied by these really, really simple compositions. And those titles actually were devised by his studio mate at the time, who was Carl Andre, named them for him. He made each of these in each of six colors and shapes, just saying there's no one right way to combine these. This, for instance, is done in yellow, orange, green, blue, and purple as well. And then he also, these are all 1 foot by 1 foot squares when you see them upstairs, but he also did the whole version in all of the different combinations, also in 6 foot by 6 foot squares. And what we thought was a really interesting connection was that this series, this particular series that we borrowed for the show, was commissioned after Frank Stella had completed this series. It was commissioned from him by Andy Warhol, who you don't really think of as a comrade of Stella's, but nevertheless. And here is Warhol with Do-It-Yourself Landscape from 1962. And I think you'll see right away that this painting is based on the very popular paint-by-number sets from the 1950s and 1960s. They still have them today also. And there was actually an exhibition at the Smithsonian a few years ago just called Paint-by-Number, which had lots of these in it. This particular work is based on a paint-by-number set put out by the company Venus Paradise. And it was intended for colored pencils, but Warhol used it for a painting. And he did five of these works. This one is called Landscape. There's also Flowers, which we have up in the exhibition, and then Sailboat, Seascape, and Still Life. So he was really choosing these scenes that are just completely banal, almost objective, and merging high art with low art, and a sort of artist's use of color with anyone's use of color, saying you could make this for your house. Many people already have made this for their house. There's nothing different about me. This was one of the last hand-painted works that he ever did before he moved to silkscreen, and it seems like maybe he felt that he'd reached the end of the possibilities for painting once he came up with something just so completely simple. And these are among the first silkscreen works that he did. The first photo silkscreens that he did. These are the Marilyn Flavors from 1962. And before these, he had done other photo silkscreens of other celebrities, like Natalie Wood was one, Warren Beatty was another. And these are part of his first exhibition at the Stable Gallery in 1962. They were displayed in two grids of four. And he did them about 3 months after, he did them in November, about 3 months after Marilyn Monroe's suicide. And what he used was a publicity shot from her film Niagara from 1957. So they could be seen as making light of her suicide. He's calling them the Flavors and named them after different flavors, like they're lifesavers or something. Some up here, this is cherry, this one's supposed to be a bit more yellow, and this is lemon. This is grape, licorice. So he really was conflating seeing something and tasting something, and also bringing up the artificial color of all of this. Not only does it not make a difference to him whether Marilyn's on a blue background, a red background, a yellow background, they're all the same, but it also calls attention to the Clairol color of her hair and Marilyn herself using imitation or fake colors for beauty in her hair, in her lipstick, in her eyeshadow. So what he was doing here in part was also removing the idea of an artist as a genius or an artist as a genius colorist in our context. He once said, quote, "I think it would be so great if more people took up silkscreens so that no one would know whether my picture was mine or someone else's." And then he also had a quote that I thought was interesting that about his sort of absurd and simple idea of filling in the colors on these silk screens. He said, "I take my little blue brush and I blue it over there, and then I take my green brush and I put my green brush on it and I green it there, and then I walk back and I look at it and I see if it's spaced right." So it's just this completely simple, completely easy way of coming up with these works that he professed for himself. This is Gerhard Richter's 10 large color panels from 1966. Hold on 1 second, excuse me. And for the 4 years before he created this work, Richter had almost exclusively worked from black and white photographs, black and white amateur photographs, and just done paintings of them. And he was using them because he thought that he wanted something that was free from any sort of subjectivity, just photographs that he would find and then just paint. It's not involving the artist or involving any sense of emotion in any way. And this is what he thought that color charts could do for him. This work is based on color charts that he had around his house from hardware stores. And he did 18 of these in 1966, which was his first extended use of color in any works that he ever did. He thought that all other types of color were emotive or expressive, and that color chart color was just completely blank, and so thought it was something that he could really use. And he also said that he didn't think he could make anything more beautiful than this, than just these flat, blank colors. He also used lacquers to make them, so again, not fine artist paints. And if you can tell, he left spaces on the right to maybe indicate a space that a number or a title of the color could fit next to each of them. And so it's not just in their the way that they look that they resemble a color chart, but also that name that could be added in. He did take liberties with the colors and arrangements. That he, as he said, he did sort of put things next to each other as he wanted them, but he still was working from this color chart as a major influence on him. He then returned to color in 1971 with another work that you can see up in the show, and did a lot of other colors based color chart paintings based on mathematical systems. This work is by Saul LeWitt, who has two works up in our exhibition. And this is called, if you can't see it, it's wall drawing 91 from 1971, and it's called A 6-inch Grid Covering the Wall. Within each square, not straight lines from side to side, using red, yellow, and blue pencils. Each square contains at least one line of each color. So for LeWitt, his wall drawings were completely based on the directions that he gave out for them. It's a complete removal of the artist. He would leave the decisions regarding how many lines, say, are in each box or what direction those lines go in to his assistants. He died in 2007, just last year, and so we had two of his assistants come and make these works. And he once said, quote, "What the work of art looks like isn't too important. The idea is the machine that makes the art." So what he did was he just prescribed in this early wall drawing just red, yellow, and blue pencils, three basic colors, and just let the work make itself without his involvement at all. He had started making wall drawings, I should say, in 1968, and 71 was the first year that he'd involved color. This is another one from the same year, 1971, wall drawing 84, a 12-inch square filled in by using all of the Crayola crayons in the pack of 12. And this is on view upstairs. And I think another quote by LeWitt that I think is interesting when you look at this is he said, "If it turns out to be beautiful, I don't mind." And I think that's sort of what happened with this one. What we didn't know when we requested this work and that we only found out as they were installing it is that it's not only that you use all 12 of the Crayola crayons, you use all 12 of the crayons. So it's a very, very thick drawing. It actually has 12 crayons in it. And there's no prescribed order for them. So there's actually another version of this in the basement of PS1 that just looks completely black. And I don't know if that's because of whatever color they put on last or because it's faded to that color in the years that they've had it. But we got the assistant to show us, to take a picture for us at each stage of the game. We somehow misplaced number 5. Sorry. But here are the rest of them. So you can see how different it could have looked within this system. It still could have been really very different works depending on which one ended up on top. I think we were fortunate to get, I think, hot pink and purple right at the top of the sequence. They don't make 12 packs of Crayola crayons anymore. They make them in multiples of 8, so they had to estimate exactly which colors it would have been. I think there was also a problem because at the time when this was first made, there was a crayon called Flesh, and so they had to substitute that out for something that they still have in the crayon pack. This is Dan Flavin's Untitled to Don Judd Colorist from 1987, and Don Judd we'll talk about in a minute. Dan Flavin, his work is sort of in a tunnel in the show, and as you walk through, you'll notice that after Dan Flavin, you move into more contemporary work post-1980, and we were sort of trying to use an artist who was working from the early 60s up through the 80s as our entrance point into contemporary art. It was really in the 1980s that Flavin started to work with chromatics in different colors. Earlier than that, this is his first work with fluorescent bulbs. This is untitled, The Diagonal of May 25th, 1963. And you'll see that in earlier works like this one, which might be what you're more familiar with, he wouldn't really combine colors as much. It's just one color, that's the entire work. But throughout, he has consistently only used industry standard bulbs, fluorescent bulbs, and only industry standard colors that are available to him. So he uses bulbs in lengths of 2 feet, 4 feet, and 8 feet. And then there's also one that's, I think, a 1 foot circle. He'll use that occasionally as well. But when he's in Europe, he doesn't insist on the American standard. He'll use what their standard is on the metric system. They have different size fluorescent bulbs, and so he'll replace in the most close in size for that. But all throughout, also, he's just used industry standard colors, and these are the 10 that he uses. Red, green, pink, blue, yellow, occasionally ultraviolet, and then 4 different colors of white: soft white, cool white, daylight, and warm white. So I think you can see, even in that list, that the needs that the industry has had for fluorescent bulbs have mostly been in white. And I think it's sort of funny to think of these different colored whites as having any effect, as no one really, you know, thinks of standardized fluorescent light very often. But this work, To Don Judd Colorist, combines all 5 of those colors, not the white bulbs and not ultraviolet, in one work. And he would work in systematic ways like this. So the top bulb, again, this is not a great slide, the top bulb here is pink, and then he would use pink, and then red, yellow, blue, and green. So he would combine each of those colors with pink and then find something chromatic from that. And he liked the limitations that he put on himself. He said, quote, "I want to do what I can with the limitations of the instruments I have come to prefer." He hated being compared to artists working in neon, because neon you can get in whatever color you'd like. If you're advertising Budweiser or anything else, you can get it made to order. But these fluorescent bulbs were of standard color, of standard size, and he really enjoyed using that. He also once, quote, said, "The contents of any hardware store could supply enough exhibition material to satisfy the season's needs of the most prosperous gallery." So as I said, that work was dedicated to Donald Judd. And Donald Judd and Dan Flavin are both major minimalist artists who were friends throughout their careers. Donald Judd's son's name is Flavin. And this is a Donald Judd work from 1989. It's untitled, and it's in our collection. It's really long. I think it's about 22 feet long, and it's up on the landing before you enter the major part of the exhibition. And Judd is another minimalist artist who got far more colorful in the 1980s. Until 1984, he had never combined more than 2 colors in any one work. And I just want to give you a sense of other works that he'd done that might be more typical of Judd. Earlier works, these stacks, and then these works outside in Marfa, Texas. So this was really a departure for him. He had, however, since 1963, used colors that were intended for Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and had also used colored plexiglass. And the reason that he liked colored plexiglass is you could just order it, and it came pre-colored. The color was inside the material, so there was no sort of separation, or it didn't seem like the color was being painted on. He wanted to use things as they came to him. And for these works as well, which he did 6 of, these colors would be already on these sheets of aluminum when he purchased them. The colors came from the RAL, R-A-L, color chart, which is a color standard in Europe. So he would use these colors off of RAL and just call the company and say, okay, I need these pieces of aluminum in color 3254, 1076, et cetera, and then they would get delivered to him already painted onto these pieces, and he would attach them as he wanted. Oops, just want to show you one other thing. So here's another one of these works. He made 6 of these large works between 1984 and 1989. And up here, what we thought was really interesting are these studies that he would make to put them together. As you can see, for this work down here, he's actually using the color chips to design it. So these RAL color tips, you can see their titles at the bottom, and he would just sort of plot it out for himself using letters or using the actual chips. What's also interesting is how much the shape of each of these aluminum panels mimics the shape of the chips. I think he was really using those as a starting point for these works of art. I think he purposely made sure to put these edges of each of these aluminum panels facing out because he didn't want to seem compositional at all. Each of these different panels that get screwed together only has one color. They're all individual units, and they're separated by these edges that can be perceived by a viewer. And here's what he had to say about using color in these works. Quote, "In the sheet aluminum works, I wanted to use more and diverse bright colors than before. I especially didn't want the combinations to be harmonious or to be inharmonious in reaction, which is harder to avoid. I wanted all of the colors to be present at once. I didn't want them to combine. I wanted a multiplicity all at once that I had not known before." Another thing that I think is interesting as you think about Judd and his standardized color for this work is also the standardized size that he used for these works. They're all 50 centimeters long and 50 centimeters tall. Each of these individual pieces are 50 centimeters long, and then together, 50 tall. And then the proportion of this is the same proportion as this. So he was really keeping himself to sort of these strict rules. And also when he went to work with this Swiss company that was producing these pieces of aluminum for him, he switched his thinking. He had always worked in combinations of measurements that made sense in inches and feet, like 12 by 24, but here he goes to centimeters and immediately everything makes sense in centimeters, 50 by, I think, 750 or 600 centimeters in this case. So Byron Kim is the first artist that takes us into post-1980s contemporary art. And this is one of the works in the show that really delves into the identity politics of the 1980s and 1990s. That was a very popular subject in art at that time. And this type of ready-made color in this color chart is really personal color. This work is called Synecdoche. It's from 1991 to the present. He's still making panels for it. He so far has made nearly 400 panels. And he would take the colors just from skin colors. So either family members or people who he met on the street who he invited to pose for him, or also some famous artists have commissioned him to do panels of their own skin colors. We have one of Vito Acconci, one of Bryce Marden, and one of Via Selmans. And a synecdoche indicates that a part is standing in for a whole. So I think you can see this both as someone's skin color standing in for the person, but also this chart of all of these skin colors standing in for the chart of all of the skin colors in the world. And on an Excel spreadsheet that he gave us when he lent us this work, he also just has listed, you know, let's say it says Vito Acconci, it'll say back of arm in parentheses. So he knows exactly what part of their bodies he was working with. And the way that he has avoided subjectivity, as so many artists in the show have, is that he's arranged these alphabetically by first name. So up in this corner, it might be Angela, and then down here we'll have Zeke or Zane or something like that. But you can see this. We have all the names listed up on the panel describing the work in the exhibition. And so I think he's also really challenging the idea of the monochrome, like Eve Klein was, this lofty, specialized work of art that has nothing to do with everyday life is now brought into life so completely. It's just part of life. It's part of our own skin. This is David Batchelor, and it's called Found Monochromes of London, and he's been making this work since 1997. It's a photographic series. And David Batchelor also wrote a book that was important to our show called Chromophobia, and has thought a lot about mass-produced color. He calls these works monochromes of modern life. And you can see that what he was doing was just finding blanks in the city, blanks of white in London in this case, and would photograph them as though they were portraits. So you can see they're usually above the center of the composition and sort of the same size that someone's head might be if you were just taking a snapshot of them. And he really is, again, challenging the monochrome because of his involvement in the city in these works. He would walk and bike around the city and just find these and snap them when he could. And there's also a trace of the subjective in here, a personal experience, because he would find them, say, on the way to his girlfriend's house or on the way to his job, so not in Trafalgar Square. He's sort of avoiding larger monuments of the city, as he gives you exactly what he was dealing with in the city. And I think, he also has done these in other cities. One place where he has really enjoyed success is in Sao Paulo, Brazil, because in 2006 they passed a law there outlawing billboards. So he's been able to sort of go through and just take a lot of photographs of white spaces that are billboards that have been covered over. And this is Angela Bullock with Standard Universal 256 from 2001. And this is just to show you our exhibition going into the digital age. Bullock is working with the 256 color options on an OS 9 Macintosh computer. So you know when you're changing a font color and you pull down and you see a grid there, it's that type of grid that she took as the colors for these works. And they flash slowly through each of those 256 colors on the screen that she's developed. So this is just a shot of our catalog and of a Jim Lambie piece. And I just wanted to remind you today, mass-produced color almost isn't a restriction anymore for artists. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Photoshop has 17 million colors that people can choose from, so it's almost there's no way that artists can't use this. It's just infiltrated completely. MoMA, our logo is MoMA Red and is licensed by Pantone, which is a company that makes sure that MoMA Red looks the same in New York as it does all around the world by selling the recipe for it. It's the same with Barbie Pink. It's the same with Gap Blue. It's all of these companies really rely on these color matching systems to make sure that when they print a brochure here, it's the same as anywhere else. And I just wanted to end with one little anecdote about how the acceptance of mass-produced color has really made its way even into popular culture. And identifying numbers by color has... identifying colors by number has become almost standard practice. There's a song by the Magnetic Fields, I think from 1999, called Rena Dakota, that has a line, "You know you enthrall me, and yet you don't call me. It's making me blue. Pantone 292. So I sort of express that. So thank you for coming. I'll take questions after this. I just wanted to tell you there are events coming up regarding the show. On April 9th, there's a lecture at 6:30. With David Batchelor, the artist, and one of our conservators, Chris McGlinchey. And then there's also two related exhibitions, one directly outside called Machine for Living Color with archival materials, and then Color Lab upstairs, which is for kids to play with ready-made color. So thanks so much for coming.